Support for Prey Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and Northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of our show today, we'll chat with our news director, Dave Thompson, and review this big week of news here in North Dakota. And Matt Olin stops by the Main Street studio. He'll review the movie Songs of Earth. We begin today's show with my colleague Matt Olin as he visits with Beth Richardson, the Consul General of Canada, who works with her office in Minneapolis to foster better relationships and expand trade between North Dakota, Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, and South Dakota. Those states do about $50 billion of trade with Canada. Here's Matt Olin with Beth Richardson in an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show.
Welcome to Prairie Pulse, Beth.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt.
Before we start, just tell folks a bit about yourself, your background, where you're from originally.
Sure, yeah. I'm really delighted to be back in Fargo. Thank you for having me on your show.
Of course.
I'm from the Prairies. We call the what you call the Great Plains, we call the Prairies. In Canada, I'm from Edmonton. I grew up in a military family, not an ag family, but both my parents were in the military, so I grew up on military bases, including I was born in Europe, where Canada had a military base for NATO during the Cold War, and spent most of my life in Edmonton and Ottawa, joined the Foreign Service to see the world.
Mm-hmm. What does the Consul General of Canada in Minneapolis actually do?
Yes.
What is your job?
So we have an office of about 20 people in Minneapolis. Our job is to foster better relationships, expand trade between Canada and five states. So North Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota. And we're part of a network of 12 consulates, U.S. Canadian consulates across the United States that do that work in partnership with the embassy in Washington.
So you mentioned the five states, but how do you work with each of them? I assume each of them have different issues. I mean, trade, I know, is a big deal with farming and agriculture, but tell me about each of the states and what you do.
Absolutely. So this part of the world, those five states, they do about $50 billion worth of trade with Canada. So if the United States was not a country, just this little region would be our eighth largest trading partner in the world. I think it's a really untold story. The agricultural innovation, clean tech in this part of the world, medical devices, especially in Minnesota. The energy trade with North Dakota is tremendous, about $5 billion a year between Canada and North Dakota. And so what we do in Minneapolis is we try to grow that relationship. And we're very lucky. The United States is our best neighbor to have. So it's an easy place to work. And we're very fortunate that people in North Dakota and across our region already have a wealth of experience with and partnerships in Canada.
How were you appointed, and tell me about the process you went through to get this job?
So I'm a career diplomat. Public service has always been part of my life. It's been my entire career. In our foreign ministry, we apply for positions. And I was very lucky to get this. This is my second assignment in the United States. And when you're a diplomat, being able to contribute to the largest trading relationship, the most integrated security partnership in the world between Canada and the United States, it's a real privilege.
What kinds of issues, you mentioned trade, what kinds of issues are you involved in with the states?
So we do a little bit of everything. Trade is kind of our bread and butter. So helping more Canadian companies do business here, helping American companies, organizations who want to invest in Canada. That would be one of the largest things we do. We also have a political section that works to build the relationships between Canada and the United States at the political level. So I'm sure you know there's an intricate web of institutions in the United States and Canada that partner. So that there's an International Legislators Forum, there's a Governors Association by region in the United States, which Canadian premiers also come down to. So part of our job is to be a bit of a nexus for all those different relationships. And we work very closely with Canadian provinces, especially Manitoba, Ontario, Saskatchewan, Alberta, that have quite a lot of interests down here as well.
Interesting. What kinds of groups and leaders do you meet with? And I assume you've been out there doing a lot of traveling since you were appointed last year.
Absolutely. This is my third trip to Fargo, fourth trip to North Dakota in the last 8 months since I was appointed. We have about $10 billion in trade every year with North Dakota, which is pretty impressive given our population sizes. So we work with all kinds of groups. So I'm in North Dakota this time because there's a global business connections conference put on by the North Dakota Trade Office that I'm speaking at, and we have our deputy ambassador down for that. The first time I came here, we had an Indigenous food systems dinner at Birnbaum's down the street here in Fargo, learning a little bit about Indigenous food systems and food sovereignty and how Canada and the United States could contribute to that. My first trip up this into North Dakota was actually to Grand Forks and Cavalier. Mm-hmm. So in Cavalier, we have Canadian Forces personnel stationed at the U.S. Space Force that's up there. And I went to visit them and learn a little bit more about Space Force, which is linked with NORAD, the Canada-U.S. Binational Military Command. We also have an active program of cultural collaboration. So I know there's been some film festivals up here that have shown Canadian film, and across our whole region, that's a bit of a priority for us. So yeah, that's a bit of an overview of what we do.
What are some similarities and maybe differences with the five states that you deal with? I mean, Minneapolis is that hub, that huge population center, which is very different from the kind of the rest of state of Minnesota that we, you know, our service covers the western part of Minnesota. But what are some of the differences you've noticed and similarities too?
Yeah, I mean, I think the similarities, and I'm going to come back to this untold story part, mm-hmm. because the innovations in agriculture and clean tech in this part of the world are really not well understood by Canadians, and that's part of my mandate as well, to share the story of this part of America with Canadians so that they see the opportunities here. And just the way in which technological innovation in agriculture, clean tech, med tech, is keeping Canada and the U.S. at the forefront of global change, right? The transition to the green economy, industries of the future, how we're going to make sure that we keep high-paying, well-paying jobs on both sides of the border that act in a way to sustain rural livelihoods, right? That not everybody has to end up moving to the big city. Now, every state has a slightly different economy, right? So we do a little bit more medical devices in Minnesota, right, since that's a bit of a hub. We purchase almost all of the ethanol that Iowa exports. It's a huge industry for us. North Dakota, it's overwhelmingly oil and the energy sector, right, that we do business with.
Interesting. How have your years in the Foreign Service, do you think, prepared you for this job? Tell us a little bit of your travels too.
Sure, that's a really interesting question. So this is my sixth foreign posting. I was in Seoul, let me just count through. Seoul, London, Moscow, Miami, Vilnius, Lithuania, and then Minneapolis. And as I said before, like what happens in the United States is consequential for Canadians, right? Because our economies are so integrated. And so it's sometimes sounds very exotic to go to the faraway places, but if you want to have an impact for your country, mm-hmm. you ask to be stationed in the country that's the best partner of your country. So how has my career in the Foreign Service prepared me for this? You know, I think staying curious is one of the most important parts. Curious about people, curious about cultures, not making any assumptions, trying to understand the place you're at from that group's perspective or from that region's perspective. And that's part of the reason I've picked two consulate postings in the United States instead of in Washington. It's very hard to understand a country from their capital,
right?
For all of our countries, but especially countries as vast as the United States and Canada. And I usually tell people there are many Americas, and it's important to try to understand each of them from their own perspective.
And it's the same in Canada, isn't it, Beth?
Absolutely.
I mean, Western and Eastern Canada are extremely different. If people don't understand, maybe you can just touch on that as long as you kind of mention the various states too.
Sure, yeah, sure. I mean, so I'm from Alberta. It has a very similar feel to North Dakota. They're cultures that are shaped by pioneers, mm-hmm. right? So incredible self-reliance, but also an incredible sense of community, helping each other, that sort of thing. The plains part of the United States and the prairies part of Canada, I find are more similar than one might expect. And then in Canada, we have kind of the founding provinces, Ontario, Quebec, and the Maritimes, and then British Columbia off to the west coast.
Can you talk about maybe there's kind of a big issue that you're involved with trying to smooth over with the U.S. and Canada involves the dairy industry. Can you kind of explain what's going on there? We're people that probably don't know.
Yeah, sure. So Canada and the U.S. have about $1.3 trillion in trade every year. That's like too big a number for me. It's about $3.5 million a day. So the vast majority of that is friction-free. You know, we have the USMCA, we have free trade on almost all our products. So occasionally there are irritants, and it's funny, we just had our Minister of Industry, he came to Nebraska last week, and he said, the U.S. is like our brother-in-law. We don't always call him on his birthday, but we call him if we needed to sleep on his sofa. And I really think that was quite a good example, like, of being in the same family. So irritants come up. Occasionally. But I think the important thing to note about that, and I will talk a little bit more specifically about dairy. So we share a common agreement on how to resolve disputes. And that is uncommon in international relations. Because a lot of times countries don't actually agree on how to adjudicate disagreements. And overwhelmingly between Canada and the United States, we have very firm systems, institutions, and relationships to help resolve disputes. So under the USMCA, there's a dispute panel mechanism when one country, like that's a party to the agreement, doesn't agree how some elements of the agreement are being implemented. So on dairy, the United States was looking for more access to the Canadian market. And so they filed a request for adjudication, this dispute settlement mechanism, about 2 years ago. That first panel found half in Canada's favor, half in the United States' favor. So we changed, which is very technical, but we changed the kinds of companies that can sell dairy into Canada. So the United States wanted us to go a little bit further, so they launched another dispute settlement panel, and the decision for that was rendered last November. It found in Canada's favor, so that the market access that we had offered to the United States was compliant with CUSMA, with the USMCA, and there's no requirement for us to go beyond that. And that's a decision that, some American milk producers don't love, but we all agree that the dispute settlement mechanism is the mechanism we all signed on to.
Mm-hmm. What are some other commodity areas that the U.S. and Canada deal with, especially agriculture within these five states?
Yeah. So the first obvious one is agricultural machinery. I was just sitting next to a gentleman at the Global Business Conference from Titan Machinery, and he was telling us about all the Canadian farmers, agricultural companies that procure from him. I'm going to come back to this innovation because I really feel like it's an untold story. So we have had a couple companies go out to Grand Farm to trial their agricultural technology. One of them is a Toronto company called Sustair that does high pressure precision water irrigation that will allow no-till sowing. And that's a way that farmers can save water, basically, and reduce the costs of tilling fields and still get the same result. So we're seeing a lot of those technological innovations that happen here. General Mills also has a project with Canada, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and North Dakota on regenerative agriculture to increase the yield of oats. So almost all the oats in Cheerios, for example, are grown in Canada. Then they're shipped down to the United States, they're processed in Minnesota, they're boxed, I believe, in Illinois, and then sold back to Canada. So that's an example of kind of our integrated relationship. In agriculture, for example, different parts of Canada and the U.S. specialize. So Canada exports a lot of fertilizer to this part of the United States, which is used to grow crops, which feed livestock. And in Canada, we send a lot of our livestock to the United States for processing. So for Iowa, for example, our largest export to Iowa is pigs, and our largest import is pork. So it just shows you how our economy is quite integrated in that way.
Are there any border issues that you're dealing with right now with the U.S. and Canada? Of course, the northern border gets far less coverage in the States than the southern border, but any ticky-tack things or border issues that you guys have to deal with? I know the passport is now required, for American citizens to get into Canada. It wasn't in the old days, but now it is. But anything like that going on?
Yeah, I mean, look, a secure border and regular passage of people moving across the border is critical to our national security. It's critical to American national security, and it's certainly a very high priority for the government of Canada. There's about 400,000 people that cross the Canada-US border every day. It's a huge number. We have multiple partnerships across government departments between Canada and the United States on managing the border. So we have our Royal Canadian Mounted Police, we have Customs and Border Agency in Canada that work with CBP and Border Patrol in the United States, as well as local law enforcement. So one of my first trips actually to North Dakota was to go up to Grand Forks, because that's where the sector office for the Customs and Border Patrol is. And we had RCMP, like Canadian police officers, come down and to discuss joint planning for the next year. And between Canada and the United States on some parts of the border, there's a program, an integrated program, where law enforcement can operate in the other country with the same authorities as in their home country. That's a very, again, that's unheard of in international relations, that you would let foreign police officers onto your territory to conduct law enforcement operations. But we have that between Canada and the United States because of the length, like the time period that we've been cooperating together, and our joint commitment to border security.
How many staff do you have in your office?
We have 18 people.
Okay.
In Minneapolis. About a third do trade promotion. And then another third do our manage our political relationship. I was mentioning consular, so we don't actually quite know how many Canadians are in our territory. They don't need to tell us when they come to the United States.
Okay.
And of course, there are many opportunities for Canadians to work in the United States and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And the USMCA makes that even a little bit easier. So we have a voluntary system that they can register in case there's an emergency or that sort of thing. But between Canada and the United States, it becomes very difficult to know exactly how many. But we do have...
It used to be a very fluid border.
Absolutely.
100, 200 years ago, 150
yeah,
years ago,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I remember as a kid, right?
Right?
Like, I crossed the border with my family. I was, I don't know, like six. And a guy said, "Are you Canadian?" My dad said, "Yes." He said, "Are these your Canadian children?" My dad said, "Yes." And that's it. We were
that's
on
it.
Our way.
Yep.
So... I think global security means we have to be a little bit more careful these days, but certainly it's a pretty seamless border for most people.
I think I know the answer to this, but it gets asked, does your office try to stay out of political entanglements with the U.S. presidential race, these kind of things going on?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I think many people in the world have their eyes trained on the U.S. election campaign, and I can't say that we're any different in Canada, right? It's an interesting experience. Canada and the United States were partners long before Canada was even a country, right? In terms of trade and bilateral relationships, we work with whatever administration the American people choose and have done so without difficulty for more than 200 years. So while we're avid watchers, you know, we know that we're going to be able to continue our partnership no matter what, right? And I'll also reinforce, too, our relationships expand well beyond the federal level, right? So we have governors who go to Canada, Canadian premiers, provincial premiers who are coming to the United States. There's this web of connections at the state level, state and provincial level, that also help to sustain us.
What is it that makes that U.S.-Canadian relationship so special? We talk about the unsecured border, which is bizarre to people in other parts of the world, but what is it? Can you put it into words? What makes it so special?
Sure. I mean, we have shared values and a shared view of how the world should be. We trust each other. I would say that's one of the biggest things, that we have this incredible trust that allows us to work together. And our economies are so integrated, our supply chains so integrated, that we rely on each other. And that wouldn't be possible without the trust that we have.
And you said also, if Canadians get in trouble in the U.S., you can help them. How does that work?
Sometimes so Canadians come down here and, for instance, they get injured, they end up in the hospital, that sort of thing. We offer consular services to Canadian citizens. But we also offer services to Americans who are looking at trade opportunities in Canada. So I absolutely always encourage people to get in touch.
Finally, if people want more information to contact your office, how do they do that?
Yeah, so we're online. We're on Facebook and Twitter, CanGC Minneapolis, MNPLS. And we'd love to hear from North Dakotans.
Thank you, Beth, for being on Prairie Pulse. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Matt.
That's Madeline with Beth Richardson, the Consul General of Canada based in Minneapolis. The Prairie Pulse airs Thursdays at 8 p.m. on Prairie Public Television and can also be viewed on Prairie Public's YouTube channel. Coming up next on Main Street, we're talking butterflies. For the past 25 years, pollinator species have experienced a drop in numbers. Experts say it's due to habitat loss, chemical use, and climate change. Butterflies are a pollinator that capture attention and serve as a gateway into learning about preserving habitat. Harvest Public Media's Anna Pope has more on how butterfly breeders and farms are helping in that effort.
A kaleidoscope of black and white striped butterflies surround plants in a quiet room on the Uchi Butterfly Farm in Leonard, Oklahoma.
These are zebra longwings, so they're most reliably found in southern Oklahoma, but every few years...
That's Jane Breckenridge. She has been raising butterflies here for 15 years, selling them to exhibitions and state fairs. But her work is also about preservation. The butterfly farm is on land that was allotted to her great-grandmother, who was Muscogee and Uchi. Breckenridge wants to help other Native people learn to farm butterflies and to educate about habitat conservation and cultural preservation.
So for me, I love butterflies, but it's more about how they can be ambassadors to engage people in this conversation that I think needs to happen so badly about how do we preserve ecosystems, how do we preserve wild spaces, how do we save the planet before it's too late.
The decline of pollinator populations has raised concern among scientists. For instance, the annual survey on monarch butterflies wintering in Mexico found a 59% drop in their numbers this year. Nicole Ault is the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Center of Pollinator Conservation.
You know, pollinator species in general, butterflies included, are declining, and the challenges across both bees, butterflies, and a lot of other pollinator species are very similar. Habitat loss over decades, as well as pesticide exposure, climate change, and disease.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service works with many groups, including the Uchi Butterfly Farm. The service helped provide funding to launch the Tribal Alliance for Pollinators, a nonprofit housed on the farm. Other organizations raising butterflies also hope to educate about pollinators. Ryan Malone is the owner of the Hatchery Butterfly Farm in Kansas, where he raises butterflies for events and exhibitions, and is the president of the International Butterfly Breeders Association. He's been busy making plant seed packets for people to raise butterfly-friendly plants.
If I do a butterfly release, I try to then educate people. I put like QR codes on things like scan this and you'll learn more about the plants that will help this butterfly to have more. You know, it is definitely married together.
Just as butterflies rely on certain plants like milkweed, flowers and gardens rely on butterflies for their pollination. Helping butterfly habitats helps other pollinators like bees. They're important to many crops, said Reed Johnson, an entomology professor at Ohio State University.
Well, the statistic that's usually mentioned is that a third of our food is made possible through insect or pollination from some other animal.
For instance, in Ohio, corn is pollinated through wind, while melons need insects' help.
And so a lot of the crop plants that we depend on for food really need some animal to move pollen from one flower to another, in order for that plant to set fruit to produce the nuts or the fruit or the seeds that we want to eat.
Johnson says he encourages people to plant native flowering plants to support pollinator populations. He says even a small patch of plants that can be slowly incorporated makes a difference. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Anna Pope.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including Prairie Public. A review of the news, and a movie review. That's next, after this.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story.
And that's our theme music for Prairie Public's news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Good to be back.
It's been a busy news week here in North Dakota, of course.
We've
had the primary elections. Dave, any surprises from your perspective?
The big surprise I had was how low the turnout was. It was a kind of a traditionally, you know, a primary is a traditionally lower turnout election, but even the Secretary of State had a remark about the low turnout. But there are still a few ballots that to be counted, some absentee ballots that will go in, and we'll see if there's going to be any changes when the canvassing board will meet later this month.
I have an unproven theory about why turnout is trending lower. What has left our vision since? And I claim it's the newspaper. The fact that a newspaper is not dropped on our doorsteps anymore, oftentimes talking about political races, keeping the fact that an election is in the news all the time, I think that's had an impact. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And that's been one of the sad things to see the transition. You know, as newspapers, broadcasters too are trying to keep up with online use and making sure you are where the eyes and the ears are. There's a lot of competing, shall we say, noise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from
that
internet
wasn't,
service.
That wasn't there maybe a decade ago.
That's correct. I think you had, and there was more trust in the news media, and that's something that keeps us up at night, and it keeps me up at night too. And that's why I think, you know, I work so hard, and our news department and the whole station works very hard to make sure we're a trusted source. And I think we're going to just have to keep that hard work going to make sure that when all is said and done, what we say, you can trust.
And I hope that continues to be true. From my perspective, it absolutely is, Dave, and I appreciate all of your efforts and the efforts of your department. Dave, what are your thoughts about Julie Fedorchuk's claim that opponents were texting on Election Day, saying that, hey, she's dropped out of the race?
Well, I've got a little story about that, a little anecdote. I was talking to one of the legislators over at the Capitol this morning. He said that he was sitting at breakfast, and then he was sitting with a friend, and all of a sudden this text comes in and says, oh, look, Julie Fedorchuk's dropping out of the race. And he said, I looked at that and I said, that's total BS. So there is something to this, and it might have swayed some votes, but maybe not, because they got on it right away and they said there's an FEC complaint. They've filed with the FEC, they've filed with the U.S. Attorney's Office, with the Attorney General's Office, and they have also filed with the FCC to find out where these things were coming from. But it took quotes out of context that were based on what she did at the convention when they had all the, shall we say, rigmarole at the convention. She decided to step away and said, I'm going to see in the primary, and that's what happened. And they took some of that out of context, and they took video from one of the TV stations in Bismarck, and I know they're upset as well. So this has probably caused a little bit of a roiling in politics in North Dakota.
Dave, what should we look forward to now regarding the upcoming general election?
I think this is going to be an interesting race because, you know, for a while the Democrats have been down, and we know, you know, they're trying to rebuild. If there is enough anger within the Republican Party and the fractionization of the party, the people who want more of a conservative bent or right-wing bent than the, quote, normies, end quote, you might see the Democrats do better. And I'm thinking about the statewide races. That was one thing to watch. I think you don't bet against the Republicans right now because they'll find a way to rally around their party nominees. There is a little unrest out there. You can sense it.
Dave, in today's Daily from the New York Times, it's a podcast that I listen to nearly every day coming into the studio. Their reporting now has Governor Doug Burgum on the very short list for vice presidential candidates, along with Senator Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance. He's a Republican senator from Ohio. Anything new that you're hearing there, Dave?
Not a lot, but we do know that Governor Burgum has gone through a vetting process. And the vetting process is good for vice president, or if Trump is reelected, he would be part of his cabinet, perhaps, maybe energy or commerce secretary. I haven't heard really too much because they're kind of playing things pretty close to the vest yet. And, of course, Governor Burgum was on the debate stage at times, but he did not criticize the president.
All right, Dave, we'll end our political back and forth banter here for the moment. Let's talk more news that you've been covering. MDU Representatives talks about data centers and power demands. And one of the things that was interesting to me in the story that you reported, Dave, is that this is really good for power consumers. I just can't understand how that can be.
It's kind of an odd situation because in the Ellendale area, you've got electricity coming in from traditional sources, coal-fired plants, but you've got wind power as well. And there's basically an excess of power in Ellendale. So they're saying, we locate this in Ellendale. First, you're going to use some of that power because right now there's not a lot of transmission lines to get the power to other places. So you use that power, and then you basically make the rest of the grid a little easier to deal with, if that makes any sense. The pressure on the grid is less because you can use the power right there. And there's a lot of power available in that area. It's keeping, MDU says it's keeping the rates lower for the rest of the customers in the grid. So yeah,
that's the part of the economics that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But hey, if it works for the consumer, I'm all for that.
That's right. And it's also created jobs. The data centers have created jobs. There are more data centers coming in. And I know the Public Service Commission is trying to get their hands around, what about data centers? What do we need to do? Do we need to just be informed, be part of the discussion? Or is there a siting rule for the Public Service Commission?
Dave, the insurance commissioner is proposing a study of the property insurance market here in North Dakota.
That's right. The insurance commissioner, John Gottfried, proposed this to the emergency commission. Normally, he said, yeah, we should go through the interim process. But he says it's become, you know, a bit of a bugaboo, not only in North Dakota, but nationwide. Property insurance rates are going up, and there are a lot of consumers who are a little worried about that. When John Gottfried talked about it earlier with us, he said, you know, maybe this is a good time to shop around for better deals for insurance. But he said there is a systemic issue that we need to take a look at and need to deal with, perhaps.
Is there a timeline for that study, Dave?
Not yet. First off, it has to be approved by the full budget section of the legislature. And if they agree to spend the $1.5 million, then you do the study and you try to get things ready for the 2025 legislative session.
Dave, the Emergency Commission has approved more federal fund spending for a National Guard bridge training facility. What's that about?
Well, basically, it's at Camp Grafton, and it's one of two training facilities in the military right now. They're going to be replacing some bridges, and they have to do some work on bridges. So this is a way to train National Guard soldiers to help in that, and soldiers writ large as well. You know, North Dakota was a pretty good spot to put it because there's room up at Camp Grafton, and it is already a proven training facility. But when the bids came in, it's kind of like everything else with the inflation. The bids were higher than they need, so that they need another about $3.2 million to make this happen.
And the legislature originally approved $6 million.
Right, and that was federal funding.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Emergency Commission had another $515,000 to design the project, but the bid came in at $9.7 million.
Everything's more expensive, Dave, even
sure
bridges,
is.
Huh?
It sure is.
Dave, income eligibility for the WIC program has increased.
It has, and this is a good thing for families who are income eligible for the WIC program because it will basically perhaps broaden the pool of people who are eligible to receive that WIC eligibility. And I know it increased by $185 per month, but that's, I think, again, we're talking about inflation pressure.
And for families who need WIC, this is just
absolutely
something that allows
women, infants, and children
a little farther.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Dave, what feedback have you gotten on your story about how the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library ended up in Medora?
You know, I've gotten a lot of feedback on it, and a lot of it's been positive. They said, yeah, we understood what happened, but we're glad to see Dickinson State will have a role in the library. Because at the end of the story, and this is the way I built the story, at the end of the story you had Ed O'Keefe with the Theodore Roosevelt Library Foundation saying, we have two parts to this. We have the museum part, which will be in Medora, but we have the research part, which will be in Dickinson. Mm. Now, I know that the original plan was to have it at Dickinson State University because having a library connected directly to a university makes a lot of sense. But it could be a tourist attraction, so we understand why it moved to Medora. I love the line. I had to use it. Former Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner says, we're in Dickinson. We're a forgiving lot. We're not crying in our beer anymore.
Well, they still have a connection, and that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
Dave, what else are you working on? What are we going to expect from your team next week?
That's a good question. I think there are a couple things that I would like to go to. I would like to explore the future of how candidates are chosen because of what happened at the convention and what happened at the district convention. There's some discussion about maybe overhauling that system, and I want to get it further into it with some legislators and with political science types to see, you know, what is going moving forward. I've heard just through the grapevine that maybe they just get rid of the convention system altogether and just go to the primary, because that's what happened in this case. But there may be a role for a convention.
Still have conventions maybe to discuss party policy, to get that platform hammered out, but not necessarily pick and choose winners and losers at the convention.
That's one thing that I've been hearing. We're not there yet.
Dave Thompson, he stops by and visits news with us once a week here on Main Street. Thanks for coming, Dave.
You bet, Craig. Thank you.
Matt Olean is up next. He has another movie review. Stay tuned.
Cue the music. That means it's time for Matt Olean for another movie review. Matt, Songs of Earth. This is a Norwegian film. It looks very breathtaking in scope here, and very much an adoration of nature and the kind of stillness that it takes to appreciate nature.
Yes. Yeah, so amazingly, this movie got to Fargo. I saw it at Marcus Theaters, and it was Norway's entry into the 2023 Oscars for the international feature film. Each country submits a film, and they whittle it down to five. It did not make the final five, but this was Norway's entrance, and it's a documentary. And unlike the past foreign language film Oscar rules, now documentaries can compete against narrative films. So it's a documentary directed by Margaret Olin from Norway, and it's about her parents, who are Jorgen Mikloen and her mother, Maghild Mikloen, and they live in western Norway in the valley of Oldedalen. And this is an old valley with glaciers and you know, mudslides and horrible things that have happened in this valley, but it's breathtaking. You know, her father walks. He walks every day. He's 84 years old. You know, he's out there walking. So it's really a film about her parents and their relationship to nature and to this valley. And throughout the film, you're right, the cinematography is breathtaking. I mean, if this was eligible for, like, the cinematography Oscar against narrative films, I think it would have been nominated. It's just breathtaking. Sometimes you don't even know what you're looking at until the camera zooms out to show you a glacier or a pond or a horse or something like that. So it's really amazing. Very slow, very contemplative. It's really more about her father as he kind of talks about all these people in the past that maybe were killed in snow slides and avalanches and glaciers and things like that. So it's really kind of this living with nature, and you get the sense that her parents are in the middle of nowhere. Like, if something happened to them health-wise in the middle of winter, I don't know what's going to happen. That was the first thing that came to my mind is, my, you must be worried about her parents. And in the film, she, you know, interviews her parents. They talk about when they pass on and how they don't want her to be sad, the daughter. They want her to think about the good times. But yeah, it's an amazing meditation on nature, living with nature, respecting nature. Mm-hmm. And these people are really healthy. They look like they're going to make it another 10 years to me watching this movie. But it's a very slow movie, so I want people to know, if you see this, it is slow. You got to focus. It's only about 90 minutes long, but I really did like it. You know, it might be a little slow for, you know, if you want to go see a mainstream narrative movie, this is probably
this
not
is
the
not
one
a
to
Marvel
see. But if you're of Norwegian descent or even not, I think it's interesting to go look at this amazing valley in western Norway that I've never seen, you know, film of.
Yeah, it feels like it gets into the question of, you know, what does it mean to be a human as it relates to how we fit into nature rather than being sort of apart from nature.
Exactly. That is what I think it's about. And her dad is really interesting to watch and to listen to in this movie. You know, he talks about his parents and his grandfather, and his, you know, his dad was orphaned by his grandfather, I think, died when his dad was like seven, and his dad had to assume farm duties when he was like 11 or something like this. So it's, you get the sense of the hardship of life. And the director, Margaret Olin, who's, of course, as I said, the daughter of the two people she focuses on, she mixes in a lot of historical photographs of people dying in the valley, and that's very kind of hard to watch. But I like how she did that to kind of suggest, you know what, this is dangerous to live here. It's not just idyllic. You have to respect nature. You have to understand that you're trading off kind of not living in the big city. There's a trade-off. You don't want to live in the big city. You want to live with nature, but it's dangerous too, especially if you fall ill or... And these glaciers that are in the valley are very ominous, Ashley, in the movie. They're kind of overlooking the valley, and you wonder, are those going to melt someday and all heck is going to break loose? They don't really get into that in climate change or anything like that in the documentary. But as I watched those glaciers in the old Adalan Valley, which are wonderfully shot by her and her camera or her videographer, cinematographers, I should say, you just wonder, wow, would I feel comfortable living next to a glacier that size? It's very ominous to watch.
Yeah, it feels like a little bit it could be a meditation on self-reliance, too.
Yes, it is, I think for sure. He talks about that a lot, and so does her mother. But anyway, like this movie a lot. Check it out. Check your listings. I think it is still in the Fargo area statewide. Just check your movie listings, Songs of Earth.
And the director, Margaret Olin, she directed the gluttony portion of a Norwegian film project on the Seven Deadly Sins.
Oh, yes.
And that leads me to our Oscar trivia. So not the gluttony scene in the movie Seven, which was directed by David Fincher, who went on to be nominated for what three films?
Social Network. Curious Case of Benjamin Button and Mank. Did he direct Mank?
Yep. Okay. All right. We've been to the movies with Matt Olin.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Patrick Otuma. Otuma was born on October 14th, 1975, and he grew up in Cork, Ireland. He got interested in writing at a young age. When I asked him about this, he said, "I was lucky to grow up in a country that placed strong emphasis on poetry in both the Irish and English languages, so poetry was always a part of me. I began writing to express teenage melodrama as well as teenage survival, and I never stopped. I wrote voraciously throughout my teens and 20s, never imagining I'd be published. I wrote to survive. I read to survive. I learned more about writing from vulnerable artists than clever ones, although sometimes a vulnerable artist can also be clever. I still write like that, searching for the ache that seems to be wanting ink and paper, and curling around that ache in the hope that something that echoes the original hunger can find itself on a page." After graduating from Maryvale Institute in Birmingham, England, where he received his BA in Divinity, he attended Queen's University Belfast, where he took a master's in theology. His books include In the Shelter, Readings from the Books of Exiles, Sorry for Your Troubles, and Daily Prayer with the Corrymeela Community. More on Corrymeela in a minute. Otuma has been published widely in Europe and America. He has appeared on NPR's The Moth Radio Hour, and he is the theologian in residence for NPR's On Being. He lives in Ireland. Today's poem is Enjoy Your Pint. If you're a frequent listener to the show, you know that Ireland means a great deal to me. It's where my mother was born, and it's my ancestral homeland. For most people around the world, especially between the years 1969 and 1998, Northern Ireland was a place of sectarian violence. This was euphemistically called the Troubles. What happened in the last few decades of the 20th century to Northern Ireland wasn't a religious war so much as it was a war of identity and nationalism. To live in Belfast meant knowing which part of the city belonged to Catholics and which part belonged to Protestants. The colors green and orange came to represent tribal belonging. It didn't matter if you wanted to be neutral about the troubles. You were labeled as either being on one side or the other. Questions like where you went to school, what football team you supported, what street you lived on, and even how you pronounced the letter H were all subtle indicators of which side you might be on. So, to live in Northern Ireland, or the north of Ireland as it's also known, is to look for clues about which communities surround you. Otuma, it is worth noting, is a former leader of the Corrymeela community. Corrymeela is Ireland's oldest peace and reconciliation center. It works with over 10,000 people a year to help blur the boundaries of conflict so that people might understand each other a little better and help them see themselves as neighbors instead of enemies. I've had the good fortune of leading several study abroad programs to Northern Ireland, and whenever we visit Corrymeela, my students are very reluctant to leave. It is a place of honesty and openness, it is a place of mindfulness, and it is a place for hard questions about injustice and hatred. Put another way, it's a point of light in the darkness. All of these things come together in our poem for today. What I really like about Otuma's poem is how it can be read. He doesn't give us any clues how we should understand the final line. Should it be said with anger, frustration, resignation, hope? It's up to the reader to figure these things out. He offers us an invitation, and in that space, it says much about how we view the world. This is Enjoy Your Pint by Patrick Otuma. At the bar, in an unknown part of Birmingham, I bought 2 pints and paid with paper money from the northern part of Ireland. That's not British money, the publican said. And I said, yes, it is. You'll see the royal head if you hold it to the light. And a man standing right beside me turned to me and looked and said, so you're from Northern Ireland. He was wearing denim jeans and a denim jacket, tobacco fingers fixed around a half-drunk pint. He locked his eyes on me and moved so near I could have kissed him. Whose side are you on, son? He whispered. Whose side are you on? And I didn't know the landscape of belonging in this part of England. I hadn't seen signs enough to know whether his hope flew for the orange or the green. He continued to look. He continued to keep close. And I said, I hope for peace. And he said, that's a clever answer, son. That's a very clever answer. And I said, I know. Enjoy your pint. And I got up to go.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded remotely and produced by Peter Folliard. We both send our best wishes. Thank you for listening.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 13th. What do you first think about when you think about the word macaroni? Many likely think about macaroni and cheese. Others, maybe older, might think of Yankee Doodle riding on a pony who, for some reason, stuck a feather in his cap and called it macaroni. When North Dakota wheat farmers think of macaroni, they think of pasta from semolina flour made from their abundant Durum wheat. The heart of Durum wheat country in the state has been in a 90-mile radius around Devil's Lake, which annually produced about 90% of the U.S. total. The land in this Durum Triangle is higher than the rest of the surrounding farmland, making outdoor temperatures about 5 degrees cooler, perfect for Durum. From Durum wheat kernels comes macaroni, egg noodles, and spaghetti. Back in 1955, Devil's Lake celebrated all things macaroni at its Macaroni Festival, and Monday, June 13th was the final day of the event. The festival featured marching bands and colorful floats in the macaroni parade. There were also kiddie rides and golf and baseball tournaments. Devil's Lake also publicized its big eating contests, one of which involved 11 North Dakota mayors trying to eat an equally measured platter of spaghetti in the fastest time. Enderlin's Doris Smith, the state's only woman mayor, out-ate the other mayors, winning in slightly less than 2 minutes. June 13th was the day of a free spaghetti dinner. The city had brought in the celebrated chef of the Omaha Athletic Club, Rinaldo Sibilia, who cooked up enough spaghetti for 7,000 servings. She stirred up 240 gallons of sauce to cover almost 1.5 million feet of spaghetti. That's almost 260 miles worth of spaghetti. The Macaroni Festival was topped off with a Mrs. Macaroni contest. The winner was Mrs. Janet Eggle of Candu, the wife of a Durham wheat farmer and the mother of three sons. Thus ended the 1955 Macaroni Festival. Started in 1950 as Macaroni Day, Devil's Lake continued to host the festival into the decade. As for Mrs. Macaroni, Janet and husband Fred not only worked side by side as farmers, but they also built and operated the Sportsman's Motel and Candu's Durham House Supper Club. Today's Dakota Datebook written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck, retired MSU Moorhead History Professor. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are happy that you have spent time with us today. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, we'll air The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. This week's topic, how do we take the politics out of climate change? And at 7 p.m., we'll air Ira Flatow and Science Friday. We look forward to being with you again Monday on Main Street.